had forsaken the absurd in order to engage with such good, if not invariably brave, causes as the civil rights movement, the struggle against thermonuclear statism, and the ending of an unjust war in Indochina. I was myself of this period, and have witnessed some truly marvellous moments at first hand. I shan't tell you my stories unless you specifically request them. I know that nothing is more tedious than the front-line recollections of a 60s radical. Nobody in the supposedly affluent and disillusioned 50s had seen any of this coming. I'm quite certain that there will be future opportunities for people of high ideals, or of any ideals at all. However, in the fairly long interval between 1968 and 1989, in other words, in that period where many of the revolutionaries against consumer capitalism metamorphosed into civil society human rights activists, there were considerable interludes of quietism and stasis. And it was in order to survive those years of stalemate and realpolitik that a number of important dissidents evolved a strategy for survival. In a phrase, they decided to live as if. I'm never certain which author can claim the credit for this mild-sounding but actually deeply subversive and ironic decision. Vaclav Havel, then working as a marginal playwright and poet in a society and state that truly merited the title of absurd, realized that resistance in its original insurgent and militant sense was impossible in the Central Europe of the day. He therefore proposed living as if he were a citizen of a free society, as if lying and cowardice were not mandatory patriotic duties, as if his government had actually signed, which it actually had, the various treaties and agreements that enshrine universal human rights. He called this tactic the power of the powerless, because even when disagreement can be almost forbidden, a state that insists on actually compelling assent can be relatively easily made to look stupid. You can't achieve 100% control over humans, and if you could, you could not go on doing so. It is, fortunately, too much responsibility for any human to assume, not that this keeps the control freaks from continuing to try. At around the same time, and alarmed in a different way by many of the same things, the morbid relationship of the Cold War to the nuclear arms race, Professor E.P. Thompson, whom I recommended to you earlier, proposed that we live as if a free and independent Europe already existed. Some people are still offended if one mentions these two men in the same breath, and Thompson would never have claimed that they both ran the same risks. But actually the two movements for human rights and disarmament were latently symbiotic at the beginning and had become quite closely related by the end. And we know with certainty from the memoirs of some of the statesmen of the period that it was the stubborn, non-violent cultural and political rebellions of those years that impelled them to recast their assumptions. The process often involved an inversion in the usual relationship between the ironic and the literal. The people power moment of 1989, when whole populations brought down their absurd rulers by an exercise of arm-folding and sarcasm, had its origins partly in the Philippines in 1985, when the dictator Marcos called an opportunist snap election and the voters decided to take him seriously. They acted as if the vote were free and fair, and they made it so. The forgotten fact that the Soviet ambassador to Manila took the side of Marcos was also a portent of a kind. Again, I've slipped into recounting these legendary moments as if they vindicated dissenters, as they most certainly do, and as if they were self-evident good, brave causes, which they most certainly were. But it's important to remember the many dreary years when the prospect of victory appeared quite unattainable. On every day of those years, the as-if pose had to be kept up until its cumulative effect could be felt. Many of the greatest as-if practitioners, including Thompson himself and men like František Kriegel in then Czechoslovakia, did not live long enough to see the grand production for which they had kept up the optimistic but phlegmatic rehearsals. One could add further examples. In the late Victorian period, Oscar Wilde, master of the pose but not a mere poseur, decided to live and act as if moral hypocrisy were not regnant. In the Deep South in the early 1960s, Rosa Parks, after some arduous dress rehearsals of her own, decided to act as if a hard-working black woman could sit down on a bus at the end of the day's labour. In Moscow in the 1970s, Alexander Solzhenitsyn resolved to write as if an individual scholar could investigate the history of his own country and publish his findings. They all, by behaving literally, acted ironically. In each case, as we know now, the authorities were forced first to act crassly and then to look crass, and eventually to fall victim to stern verdicts from posterity. However, this was by no means the guaranteed outcome, and there must have been days when the as-if style was exceedingly hard to keep up. All I can recommend, therefore, apart from the study of these and other good examples, is that you try to cultivate some of this attitude. In an average day, you may well be confronted with some species of bullying or bigotry, or some ill-phrased appeal to the general will, or some petty abuse of authority. If you have a political loyalty, you may be offered a shady reason for agreeing to a lie or a half-truth that serves some short-term purpose. Everybody devises tactics for getting through such moments. Try behaving as if they need not be tolerated and are not inevitable. Chapter 6. A postscript to the above. Be prepared in advance for the arguments you will hear, even in your own head, against such a mode of conduct. Some of these are very seductive. What difference does it make, you may be asked, or ask yourself. There's no good answer to this question, as it happens. The universe may well be absurd, and one's life is, in any case, certain to be a short one. However, this need not mean that we do not reserve the term absurd for the self-evidently irrational or unjustifiable. You can't hope to change human nature, or human nature. True enough again, if slightly tautologous, because nature is a given, but nobody accepts all human behaviour or human conduct as unalterable on that basis. Other invitations to passivity or acquiescence are more sly, some of them making an appeal to modesty. Who are you to be the judge? Who asked you? Anyway, is this the propitious time to be making a stand? Perhaps one should await a more favourable moment, and, aha, is there some danger of giving ammunition to the enemy? I have two favourite texts that I keep by me to exorcise these sorts of temptation. One is an essay written by George Orwell in November 1945, and entitled Through a Glass, Rosalie. He was writing at a time when the Red Army had just liberated much of Nazi-occupied Europe, and when it was considered very poor form in some circles to make any criticism of the liberators. The Vienna correspondent of Tribune, the socialist weekly for which Orwell worked, had, however, seen fit to mention the rape and looting committed by Soviet forces in the city. The recent article by Tribune's Vienna correspondent provoked a spate of angry letters which, besides calling him a fool and a liar and making other charges of what one might call a routine nature, also carried the very serious implication that he ought to have kept silent, even if he knew he was speaking the truth. Whenever A and B are in opposition to one another, anyone who attacks or criticizes A is accused of aiding and abetting B. And it is often true, objectively and on a short-term analysis, that he is making things easier for B. Therefore, say the supporters of A, shut up and don't criticize, or at least criticize constructively, which in practice always means favorably. And from this it is only a short step to arguing that the suppression and distortion of known facts is the highest duty of a journalist. Taking an excellent example of the process at work, Orwell cited the cleverness of Nazi propaganda in the war that had just ended. Among others, they broadcast E.M. Forster's A Passage to India, and so far as I know, they didn't even have to resort to dishonest quotation. Just because the book was essentially truthful, it could be made to serve the purposes of fascist propaganda. According to Blake, a truth that's told with bad intent beats all the lies you can invent. And anyone who has seen his own statements coming back at him on the Axis radio will feel the force of this. Indeed, anyone who has ever written in defense of unpopular causes or been the witness of events that are likely to cause controversy knows the fearful temptation to distort or suppress the facts, simply because any honest statement will contain revelations that can be made use of by unscrupulous opponents. But what one has to consider are the long-term effects. One who had anticipated these long-term consequences, but who also cared about the immediate ones, was F. M. Cornford, a witty Cambridge academic of the Edwardian period, who had become used to every possible high-table euphemism and senior common-room obfuscation. He anatomized them all in his 1908 treatise, Microcosmographia Academica. The passage I'll give you is from Chapter 7, entitled Arguments. There is only one argument for doing something. The rest are arguments for doing nothing. Since the stone axe fell into disuse at the close of the Neolithic Age, two other arguments of universal application have been added to the rhetorical armory by the ingenuity of mankind. They are closely akin, and, like the stone axe, they are addressed to the political motive. They are called the wedge and the dangerous precedent. Though they are very familiar, the principles, or rules of inaction, involved in them are seldom stated in full. They are as follows. The principle of the wedge is that you should not act justly now for fear of raising expectations that you may act still more justly in the future, expectations that you are afraid you will not have the courage to satisfy. A little reflection will make it evident that the wedge argument implies the admission that the persons who use it cannot prove that the action is not just. If they could, that would be the sole and sufficient reason for not doing it, and this argument would be superfluous. The principle of the dangerous precedent is that you should not now do any admittedly right action for fear you, or your equally timid successors, should not have the courage to do right in some future case, which, ex hypothesi, is essentially different, but superficially resembles the present one. Every public action that is not customary either is wrong or, if it is right, is a dangerous precedent. It follows that nothing should ever be done for the first time. Another argument is that the time is not ripe. The principle of unripe time is that people should not do at the present moment what they think right at that moment, because the moment at which they think it right has not yet arrived. You may, and I assure you of this, be certain that you will meet some combination of these arguments and evasions as you go through life. You may not always have the energy to combat each of them every time. You may find that you want to husband and conserve your resources for a better cause or a more propitious day. Beware of this tendency in yourself. Be alert, especially, for that awful day when, without even having meant to do so, you find that you have uttered one of these consoling and corrupting formulations yourself. Here's a case, incidentally, where neither the sacred nor the profane are of any help. I've sometimes found it useful to say, "Damn it, I have only one life to live, and I won't spend a moment of it on some dismal compromise." But then comes the unprompted thought, "With only one lifespan, might I not save some time by ducking this one minor combat?" I imagine that those who hope for the hereafter are tempted in the same way, but in a different idiom. Many are the issues of principle that seem trivial sub specie aeternitatis. Chapter 7. I'm so glad that you liked the Microcosmographia. It's a delight in itself, of course, but I keep it by me as a reminder that many questions are actually quite simple. There's a small paradox here. The job of supposed intellectuals is to combat oversimplification or reductionism and to say, well, actually, it's more complicated than that. At least that's part of the job. However, you must have noticed how often certain complexities are introduced as a means of obfuscation. Here it becomes necessary to ply with glee the celebrated razor of old Occam, dispose of unnecessary assumptions, and proclaim that, actually, things are less complicated than they appear. Very often, in my experience, the extraneous or irrelevant complexities are inserted when a matter of elementary justice or principle is at issue. My best illustration here would be the case of my dear friend Salman Rushdie. You would think, perhaps, that when he was assaulted by a theocratic fatwa in 1989, his fellow authors would have rushed to his defence. Here was an open incitement to murder, accompanied by the offer of a bounty and directed at a writer of fiction who wasn't even a citizen of the said theocracy. But you would have been astonished to see the amount of muttering and hanging back that went on. Had his novel perhaps been offensive? Were the feelings of pious Muslims not to be considered? Was he not asking for trouble? Surely he knew what he was doing, and so forth. Several senior Western statesmen, often of the law and order and anti-terrorist school, took refuge in similar evasive formulations. In public debates with those who worried about the blasphemous or profane element in the novel, or who said that they did, I would always begin by saying, "Look, let's get one thing out of the way. May I assume that you are opposed without reservation to the suborning of the murder for pay of a literary figure?" It was educational to see how often this assurance would be withheld or offered in a qualified form. In those cases, I would refuse to debate any further. So I was a reductionist in that instance and proud of my simple-mindedness. Another example, also from experience. In 1968, I travelled to Cuba. The revolution was still young. Che Guevara's murder was a memory only a few months old. The Castroites maintained that their version of socialism would not be modelled on the dreary example of Russia. There was a good deal of play and latitude. I'm not relating this to you by hindsight, because I was then a member of a Marxist group that had strong reservations about Fidelism, and if you like, I'll tell you the story of my political formation in another letter. Anyway, discussions and arguments were intense, and in the year of Vietnam and Paris and Prague seemed to be, and sometimes were, of real moment. I remember particularly a seminar with Santiago Alvarez, the grand old man of Cuban cinema. Film was the special medium of the Cuban Revolution, and he assured us that it was unfettered. "Completely unfettered?" "Well," he said with a slight laugh, "there is one thing that is not done. No satirical portrayal of the leader will be permitted." The slight laugh was at the very idea that anyone would even dream of proposing such a thing. I said, quite simply, that if the main subject of Castro was off-limits, then, in effect, there could be no real satire or criticism at all. I had heard and read of the term counter-revolutionary, but this was the first time I heard it applied in all seriousness, and to myself, at that. Again, I claim no courage for making such an elementary point, and I ran no risk save the obloquy of some of those present— but I can't forget the dead silence as I passed my observation. At another meeting, where we heard many boasts, some of them truthful, about the advances in medical care and literacy, I inquired whether a Cuban citizen could start his own magazine, or travel outside the country and return to it. Again, the view seemed to be that only a narcissist and unsound element would intrude such a question. I've been back to Cuba many times since, to find that these and related questions have become urgent, and their postponement absolutely fatal to the society. Back then, I was only asking about the obvious, and perhaps discovering that there is something to be said for Anglo-Saxon empiricism after all. It's not for nothing that we celebrate the story of the small boy and the unclothed emperor. I'm no great advocate of folkloric wisdom, but this tale has stood the test because it emphasizes what Orwell once said in another context. Very often, the hardest thing to see is what is right in front of your nose. and there is, not infrequently, a considerable social pressure not to take note of the obvious. Every parent knows the moment when children acquire the word why and begin to make use of it. I still don't know quite why the sky is blue. I did know once, but I've forgotten. But I've had to find explanations for, "Daddy, why is that man sleeping on a grating?" and for other phenomena that I had become too much used to. In societies infected by the poison of racism, it has often been children who don't suffer innately from the infection who have set the example. Of course, one should not idealize children, who are very suggestible and who make easy targets for indoctrination. And of course, innocence will only take you so far. You have to be sophisticated by experience before you are old enough to argue that, say, it might be wrong to launch a thermonuclear war, but not wrong, indeed only prudent, to prepare the weaponry of extermination, or that an act that would be a loathsome crime if committed by an individual is pardonable when committed by a state. But these are the rewards of maturity, to be enjoyed only as we decline. We are an adaptable species, and this adaptability has enabled us to survive. However, adaptability can also constitute a threat. We may become habituated to certain dangers and fail to recognize them until it's too late. Nuclear armaments are the most conspicuous example. As you listen to this, you are, in effect, wearing a military uniform and sitting in a very exposed trench. You exist at the whim of people whose power does not derive from your own consent and who regard you as expendable, disposable. You merely fail to notice the moment at which you were conscripted. A normal life consists in living as if this most salient of facts was not a fact at all. I tell myself every day that I do not recognize the legitimacy of a government that puts me in this position. I do not grant even my elected leaders the power of life and death over myself, let alone over all present, future, and indeed past forms of life, all of which they arrogate the right to extirpate at an instant's notice. Nor was I ever asked if I would grant that power, even supposing for a moment that I had the right to grant it on behalf of others, which I do not for a moment believe that I do. However, when meeting a minister or senior functionary of this regime, which is a privilege I quite often enjoy, I do not act as if I am shaking Caligula's blood-bolted mitt. I do sometimes content myself with thinking that if they knew what was in my mind and heart, they would shrivel as if cursed and blasted. So I practice cognitive and emotional dissonance. The most I can claim is that I do it consciously while waiting for better days. Try your hardest to combat atrophy and routine. To question the obvious and the given is an essential element of the maxim, De omnis dubitandum. Chapter 8. How to ward off atrophy and routine, you ask? Well, I can give you a small and perhaps ridiculous example. Every day, the New York Times carries a motto in a box on its front page. All the news that's fit to print, it says. It's been saying it for decades, day in and day out. I imagine that most readers of the canonical sheet have long ceased to notice this bannered and flaunted symbol of its mental furniture. I myself check every day to make sure that the bright, smug, pompous, idiotic claim is still there. Then I check to make sure that it still irritates me. If I can still exclaim under my breath, "Why do they insult me, and what do they take me for, and what the hell is it supposed to mean unless it's as obviously complacent and conceited and censorious as it seems to be," then at least I know that I still have a pulse. You may wish to choose a more rigorous mental workout, but I credit this daily infusion of annoyance with extending my lifespan. Chapter 9. You seem to have guessed from some remarks I have already made in passing that I am not a religious believer. In order to be absolutely honest, I should not leave you with the impression that I am part of the generalized agnosticism of our culture. I'm not even an atheist so much as I am an anti-theist. I not only maintain that all religions are versions of the same untruth, but I hold that the influence of churches and the effect of religious belief is positively harmful. Reviewing the false claims of religion, I do not wish, as some sentimental materialists affect to wish, that they were true. I do not envy believers their faith. I am relieved to think that the whole story is a sinister fairy tale. Life would be miserable if what the faithful affirmed was actually the case. Why do I say that? Well, there may be people who wish to live their lives under a cradle-to-grave divine supervision, a permanent surveillance and monitoring. But I cannot imagine anything more horrible or grotesque. It would be worse, in a way, if the supervision was benign. I have my answer ready if I turn out to be mistaken about this. At the bar of judgment, I shall argue that I deserve credit for an honest conviction of unbelief, and must in any case be acquitted of the charge of hypocrisy or sycophancy. If the omnipotent and omniscient one does turn out to be of the loving kind, I would expect this plea to do me more good than any trashy casuistry of the sort popularized by Blaise Pascal. One could also fall back upon the less principled and more shiftily empirical defence offered by Bertrand Russell. O Lord, you did not give us enough evidence. I think that this conviction does bear upon the mental and moral resources that are necessary if one hopes to live as if one were free. In a much-quoted reflection on America's original sin, Thomas Jefferson said, "I tremble for my country when I remember that God is just." However, if there really was a God, and he really was just, then there would be little enough for believers to tremble about. It would be a consolation that infinitely outweighed any imaginable earthly care. I have met many brave men and women, morally superior to myself, whose courage in adversity derives from their faith. But whenever they have chosen to speak or write about it, I have found myself appalled by the instant decline of their intellectual and moral standards. They want God on their side and believe they are doing his work. What is this, even at its very best, but an extreme form of solipsism? They proceed from conclusion to evidence. Our greatest resource is the mind, and the mind is not well trained by being taught to assume what has to be proved. This arrogance and illogic is inseparable even from the meekest and most altruistic religious affirmations. A true believer must believe that he or she is here for a purpose and is an object of real interest to a supreme being. He or she must also claim to have at least an inkling of what that supreme being desires. I have been called arrogant myself in my time, and hope to earn the title again, but to claim that I am privy to the secrets of the universe and its creator, that's beyond my conceit. I therefore have no choice but to find something suspect even in the humblest believer, let alone in the great lawgivers and edict-makers of whose flock, and what a revealing word that is, they form a part. Even the most humane and compassionate of the monotheisms and polytheisms are complicit in this quiet and irrational authoritarianism. They proclaim us, in Fulke Greville's unforgettable line, "created sick, commanded to be well." And there are totalitarian insinuations to back this up if its appeal should fail. Christians, for example, declare me redeemed by a human sacrifice that occurred thousands of years before I was born. I didn't ask for it and would willingly have foregone it, but there it is. I'm claimed and saved whether I wish it or not. And if I refuse the unsolicited gift? Well, there are still some vague mutterings about an eternity of torment for my ingratitude. This is somewhat worse than a Big Brother state, because there could be no hope of its eventually passing away. In any case, I find something repulsive in the idea of vicarious redemption. I would not throw my numberless sins onto a scapegoat and expect them to pass from me. We rightly sneer at the barbaric societies that practice this unpleasantness in its literal form. There's no moral value in the vicarious gesture anyway. As Thomas Paine pointed out, you may, if you wish, take on another man's debt, or even offer to take his place in prison. That would be self-sacrificing. But you may not assume his actual crimes as if they were your own. For one thing, you did not commit them, and might have died rather than do so. For another, this impossible action would rob him of individual responsibility. So the whole apparatus of absolution and forgiveness strikes me as positively immoral, while the concept of revealed truth degrades the whole concept of the free intelligence by purportedly relieving us of the hard task of working out ethical principles for ourselves. You can see the same immorality or amorality in the Christian view of guilt and punishment. There are only two texts, both of them extreme and mutually contradictory. The Old Testament injunction is the one to exact an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. It occurs in a passage of perfectly demented detail about the exact rules governing mutual ox-goring. You should look it up in its context. The second is from the Gospels and says that only those without sin should cast the first stone. The first is the moral basis for capital punishment and other barbarities. The second is so relativist and non-judgmental that it would not allow the prosecution of Charles Manson. Our few notions of justice have had to evolve despite these absurd codes of ultra-vindictiveness and ultra-compassion. I can speak with more experience of the Christian propaganda since I was baptized as an Anglican, educated at a Methodist boarding school with compulsory religious instruction, which I enjoyed and which taught me a good deal, and was once received into the Greek Orthodox Church for reasons that are irrelevant here. But I also had a Jewish mother and was once married by a distinguished rabbi who I suspected of being a secret Einsteinian agnostic. Judaism has some advantages over Christianity in that, for example, it does not proselytize, except among Jews, and it does not make the cretinous mistake of saying that the Messiah has already made his appearance. When Maimonides says that the Messiah will come, but that he may tarry, we see the origin of every Jewish shrug from Spinoza to Woody Allen. However, along with Islam and Christianity, it does insist that some turgid and contradictory and sometimes evil and mad texts, obviously written by fairly unexceptional humans, are in fact the word of God. I think that the indispensable condition of any intellectual liberty is the realization that there is no such thing. Chapter 10. You write to remind me that many exemplary people have been sustained by their faith. Actually, if I may be slightly strict with you, you don't remind me of the fact. I was already quite aware of it, and I have read and read of Dr. Martin Luther King and Dietrich Bonhoeffer and many of the others whom you mention. But let me ask you in turn, are you saying that their religious belief was a sufficient or a necessary condition for their moral actions? In other words, that without such faith they would not have opposed racism or Nazism? I think I have a higher opinion of both men than to say that of them. It may have helped them to employ religious rhetoric, and it certainly aided them in gaining a following. There have always been societies, by the way, in which the pulpit is the only outlet that has granted leeway or relative immunity. But as Laplace is supposed to have said when demonstrating his model of the solar system at court, and on being asked where the prime mover was, it can work without that assumption. You could have gone further and pointed out that some heroic figures like William Lloyd Garrison, the father of abolitionism, were devout believers. However, this would have involved you in recognizing that Garrison's actual theology concerning the covenant with death that the Union had made was of the same branch as is now professed by Ian Paisley, and that it incidentally called for the destruction, not the preservation, of the Union and the Constitution. We are fortunate, in other words, to be able to salute his example and discard his world view. I have also met many courageous and selfless rebels who are unreflective devotees of Islam or unquestioning believers in communism. These people, in my judgment, do not really deserve the name of dissident or oppositionist, because one can see future oppressions already inscribed in their thought patterns. No one can be entirely sure that any solution he proposes will not contain its own woes and pains by way of unintended consequence. But one must recoil when the evident and probable consequences are in fact intended, and nothing makes this more certain than the promulgation of articles of faith. Of course, faith can be admirably simple, and though I distrust the way in which simple-mindedness is often exalted by the religious, it may also have its appeal. There was an Austrian Catholic farmer named Franz Jägerstätter who refused to be conscripted into the army of the Third Reich. He gave us his reason, his maddeningly simplistic belief that he was under higher orders, to love his neighbour as himself. They beheaded him for his impudence. Very well, I doff my hat. Herr Jägerstätter was under consideration for canonization when the Vatican was looking urgently for a Holocaust martyr in the 1980s and having difficulty in coming up with one. However, it turned out that his pastors and confessors had urged him to don the Nazi uniform and obey the law, which spoiled the whole effect. Simplicity, however, is too often allied with credulity for my taste, and the credulous, especially en masse, are not a reassuring sight. As the great Eugene Debs used to tell his socialist voters in the 1912 election campaign, he would not lead them into a promised land, even if he could, because if they were trusting enough to be led in, they would be trusting enough to be led out again. He urged them, in other words, to do their own thinking. Thus, I'm not impressed when G.K. Chesterton and other apologists repeat their mantra, "If people cease to believe in God, they do not believe in nothing, but in anything." It seems to me that the original belief furnishes evidence for both parts of the latter half of the proposition, a willingness to believe both in nothing, because it doesn't exist just because they say so, and in anything, because one faith is very likely to be exchanged for another. I repeat, what really matters about any individual is not what he thinks, but how he thinks. Our conversation has been about the constituents that might go to make up an independent and a questioning person, a dissenter and free thinker. This project cannot best be approached or undertaken in a kneeling or prostrate position. I touched on the threat of hell with which the devout have always reinforced their ostensibly kindly recommendations, but just consider for a moment what their heaven looks like. Endless praise and adoration, limitless abnegation and abjection of self, a celestial North Korea. Just to spice things up, some religions promise a good deal of carnal bliss, and I think I've already mentioned one of the church fathers, Tertullian, who also dangled the tempting option of viewing the torments of the damned. All this proves is that religion is man-made, and that men have created gods in their own image rather than the other way about. Only a humourless tyrant could want a perpetual chanting of the praises that, one has no choice but to assume, would be of the innate virtues and splendours furnished him by his creator, infinite regression, drowned in praise. I'm not a supporter of materialist individualism in the Ayn Rand style, nor do I yearn for Nietzschean status. However, there is something irreducibly servile and masochistic about the religious mentality, and the critical and oppositional stance does ultimately rest on a belief in the capacity and pride of the individual, while religion tends to dissolve this into a sickly form of collectivism. Remember the flock. even at its most beautifully expressed, this has a coercive undertone. As a matter of fact, the bell does not always toll for thee, however much you may believe in human solidarity. Religion is, and always has been, a means of control. Some of those who recommend religion, I'm thinking of the school of Leo Strauss, are blunt enough to make this point explicit. It may be myth and mumbo-jumbo, but it's very useful for keeping order. If you want to be able to live at an angle to the safety and mediocrity of consensus, you will do well not to begin by granting one of its first premises. Sigmund Freud was surely right when he concluded that religious superstition is ineradicable, at least for as long as we fear death and fear the darkness. It belongs to the childhood of our race, and childhood is not always, as Freud also helped us to understand, our most attractive or innocent period. I'm almost tempted to argue for the moral superiority of secular humanism. It is at least free from any taint of opportunist wish-thinking. I do not delight in the thought of my annihilation, and I am not always consoled even by David Hume's stoic reflection that, after all, I was also nothing before I was born. However, those who persecute religion are to be avoided at all costs. Antigone taught us to trust the instinct that is revolted by desecration. Sublime works of painting and architecture and poetry have been wrought by those who, in my humble opinion, were laboring under a misapprehension, as their religious leaders indirectly confirmed by their own profanities and book-burnings and crusades and inquisitions. What I propose to you is a permanent engagement with those who think they possess what cannot be possessed. Time spent in arguing with the faithful is, oddly enough, almost never wasted. The argument is the origin of all arguments. One must always be striving to deepen and refine it. Marx was right when he stated in 1844 that the criticism of religion is the premise of all criticism. Science, as we call it, or objective and disinterested inquiry, as it should be called, has helped contain and domesticate religion and vulgar creationism, but will never succeed in dethroning it. We live in a time when the origins of the cosmos are becoming at least potentially knowable, and when the nature of humanity, its original encoding and its relation to other species, is becoming more and more distinct. Nonetheless, the argument from design still keeps recurring like a jack-in-the-box, even if, or perhaps because, it rests on that combination of tautology and infinite regression. In a way, there's no mystery about this. After all, believing what I believe about the likely randomness of human life, why do I care to write a tract like this one, advocating what I consider to be the glories of Promethean revolt and the pleasures of sceptical inquiry? What's the point? I have no answer to the question, which I believe to be unanswerable, and that is one unassailable reason why I so heartily distrust those who claim that they do have an answer. But at least they have the question, and that's something. I should not even attempt to sermonize, yet I do warn you that if you feel capable of going into internal exile and living against the stream, you can expect some dark nights of, all right, the soul. But to undertake this and then to seek external or invisible aid would surely be to miss the point. A degree of solitude and resignation is necessary to begin with. Some people can't bear solitude, let alone the idea that the heavens are empty and that we do not even succeed in troubling their deafness with our bootless cries. To be an exile or outcast on a remote shore, many minds turn away in terror and seek any source of cosiness. I can only say that not only when it is compared to the ghastliness of eternal paternalism, the concept of loneliness and exile and self-sufficiency continually bucks me up. And one might also, when confronted with this unadorned reality, learn to treat one's fellow exiles with more consideration and respect. But let's not ask for the moon. Chapter 11. Yours is not the only mail that I read, as I'm sure you appreciate, and so I know quite well that I can appear insufferable and annoying. Worse than that, I know that I can appear insufferable and annoying without intending to do so. An old definition of a gentleman, someone who is never rude except on purpose. I seem to fail this test. A beloved friend once confided to me that my lip, I think he said the upper one, often has a ludicrous and sneering look, and my wife added that it takes on this appearance just when I seem least to be aware of it. I freely admit that I was hugely unsettled by these criticisms and observations, and have spent quite some time wondering how long I'd been rude by accident instead of by design. And what of the times when I have felt myself on top form, tossing and goring my opponents, sparkling my way through the repartee, while producing no effect save dull and baffled rage? Without changing this distressing subject, I am bound to admit that I don't give a damn when similar criticisms come from those who are not friends or lovers. My mailbag and my email often contain praise. Why should I conceal the fact, and even admiration? But when the note is hostile, it is usually hostile in a particular key. The words are variously sorted and, all right, I'll allow myself this, very often misused or misspelled. But the hiss of the word elitist is almost never omitted. I know why this accusation is supposed to hurt. I know it partly because I used to employ it myself, and I have seen people go to enormous lengths to avoid the charge or to repudiate it. However, it no longer has the power to sting me. Let me explain why. Many honourable rebels and dissenters in the past were acting and speaking, as it were, for the voiceless and the unrepresented. Elitist though this may have been, it had one of its culminations in the scheme for a vanguard party that would actually substitute for the masses. It nonetheless sanctified itself by the reference to the people. Even the preamble to the United States Constitution, which was written by men who held other people as property, opens with the invocation, "We the people." In numerous invocations before and since, this tribute paid by vice to virtue has been a strong motif. Even sovereigns who speak of my people are making a semi-conscious nod to the idea, which is exactly where the trouble arises. Because there is an alternative account of dissent, wherein those who try to tell the truth are derided by the crowd or silenced by public opinion. You may have a favourite example of your own, and if you don't, you ought to have one. The case that still moves me the most, moves me even more than Zola, is the story of those civilised and intelligent and democratic individuals who opposed the declaration of the First World War. They were right, and they were decent, and they were also prescient. One might relax the term prescient in retrospect, because the horrors that eventuated were greater by far than the horrors they had foreseen. But if you consult the record and see what happened to them, Jean Jaret shot down by a fanatic, Karl Liebknecht imprisoned for his principles, Bertrand Russell silenced, you can see the suicide of a civilization. And most of the time, the cheery and patriotic mob would have been as content to see them burned alive as it was to jeer at their burning in effigy. Now, there may well have been a mob majority for war in 1914. We have no way of testing this proposition, but so it appeared. My point, however, is that governments normally suspicious of the franchise decided on this one occasion to take vox populi as vox dei, superfluous to add that they were supported in this by their respective established churches and detached institutions of higher learning. The enthusiasm of the populace could be directed at the stuck-up and the fancy and fastidious types, while the same populace was prostrate before throne and altar. Susan Sontag, in her beautiful novel The Volcano Lover, gives us a word picture of this mentality at work in a previous epoch. The scene is set in Naples during the bloody monarchist pogrom instigated by Admiral Horatio Nelson, another episode they don't tell you about in school. The crowned pretender has unleashed the mob on the eggheads. A hunting crowd looking for the telltale signs of Jacobin identity, apart from having something worth stealing, a soberly dressed man with unpowdered hair, someone with trousers, someone with spectacles. For this is something like nature, which notoriously does not act in its own interests or make judicious discriminations. Even before this energy exhausts itself, it will doubtless be reined in by the rulers who have sanctioned it. In that period, the manipulation of populism by elitism was rather a hit-or-miss affair. The church and king mobs unleashed by the authorities in Georgian England were, I don't believe I exaggerate, outlets for energy that might otherwise be directed at church and king. Instead, those who could not read were given cakes and ale for making a pyre of copies of The Rights of Man. If you read Dickens's depiction of the Gordon riots in Barnaby Rudge, you will strike much the same idea. For the party of order, disorder has always had its uses. It is not only reformers and revolutionaries who claim to speak in the name of the general will. Much the same can be said about literary and scientific and even medical matters. Books that were once banned or ridiculed or both, from the time of the condemned Socrates to the time of the forbidden Ulysses, have had to be saved not by the crowd, but from the crowd. The evidence of our own evolution had to be broken to people very gently, lest they take up some stupid slogan about the rock of ages being preferable to the age of rocks. Care still has to be taken on this point when dealing with the tender-headed. Many are the works of genius now in public libraries that would have been incinerated if a roll of opinion had been called. And since I appear to you to be fixated on this point anyway, I trust I will lose none of your respect if I remind you once again that the forces of piety have always and everywhere been the sworn enemy of the open mind and the open book. Do not think for a moment that I have exhausted this point. Nowadays, public opinion is more smoothly and easily ventriloquized. I am sure you have had the experience of making up your own mind on a question and then discovering, on the evening news of the same day, that only 23.6% of people agree with you. Ought you to be depressed or disconcerted by this alarmingly exact dissection of the collective brain? Only if you believe that a squadron of under-talented but overpaid pseudo-scientists have truly and verifiably arrived at this conclusion. And perhaps, indeed I would argue in any case, not even then. I'm sure that you are partially armoured, as most intelligent people are, against this kind of thing. Everybody knows that the question can be loaded. Everybody knows that the sample can be weighted. Everybody knows that the intelligibility of the questions depends upon the commonplace and the regnant assumptions. It's a mark of sophistication to understand these things and occasionally to announce that one distrusts or suspects them. However, these reservations don't amount to a serious critique. The first thing to notice, surely, is that these voyages into the ocean of the public mind are chartered and commissioned by wealthy and powerful organizations who do not waste their money satisfying mere curiosity. The tactics are the same as those of market research. The point is not to interpret the world, but to change it. A tendency to favour one product over another is something not to be passively discovered and observed, but to be nurtured, encouraged, and exploited. Thus, to the consumer, the pole, a suggestive word, by the way, and derived from the old and retrogressive headcount tax, may seem like a mirror of existing opinion. But to the one who produces it, the pole is a swift photograph of the raw material to be worked upon. You may have noticed that popular opinion is not always and invariably cited by the elites, nor is it consistently tested. I don't remember reading the findings of any poll about the tight money policy of the Federal Reserve. Who would pay? A properly sampled poll is quite an expensive business for such a thing. No, public opinion is not usually recycled until it has been treated. Only then are people informed whether or not their own opinion enjoys the certification of being the majority or approved one. Even general elections, which are supposed to involve voting in the active voice rather than the passive one, have been increasingly compromised by passive dress rehearsals. The polls conditioned the poll. One must therefore be willing to risk the charge of elitism in order to say that the passive participants in this are often dupes and that those who run the show are often real elitists. People in the mass or the aggregate often have a lower intelligence than their constituent parts. The word demagogue would be meaningless if this were not so. A few years ago, I decided in my own mind that the then President of the United States was even more of a crook and a liar than his most dogmatic ideological opponents had claimed. Some, but not all of this question, turned on his own private morality, which combined the frigid and the sleazy in a rare combination. One day in California, not long after a freshet of disgusting revelations about this president, I heard on my car radio the results of an instant poll. In the light of the new disclosures, people were invited to say whether they thought their own moral standards were A, higher than those of the chief executive, or B, about the same as his, or C, lower. Perhaps 20% said higher, and I remember thinking, well, even at my most self-critical, I could have managed to say the same. A broad band in the middle reported themselves as no better but no worse. Rightly is this the country that gave us the term non-judgmental. And then some 20% were announced as saying that they thought their own morals were inferior to Clinton's. By the way, that was this president's name. My first thought was of the unguessed-at extent of masochism and servility among the electorate. My second thought, which turned out to be accidentally prescient, was of the genius it had taken in a discussion of the moral fitness of the leader to turn it into a plebiscite on the morals of his subjects. From then on, I was never able to utter my view of the man in public or in private without being told that I was out of step with public opinion. But I never met an actual living, breathing individual who had been consulted by a polling organization, and I never met anyone who regarded himself as morally inferior to the president. Did I ever think I might have been wrong? Yes, sometimes, and briefly, but never because of the supposed majority against me. Now, if I were writing the above lines as a disappointed politician, I might seem like one of those droning megalomaniacs who can't forgive the laziness or the short-sightedness or the hedonism of their electorates. Brecht caught this attitude very well in 1953, when he noticed a communist leaflet upbraiding the Berliners for their thoughtless uprising against Stalinism, and dryly suggested that perhaps the party ought to dissolve the people and select another one. One must avoid snobbery and misanthropy, but one must also be unafraid to criticize those who reach for the lowest common denominator and who sometimes succeed in finding it. This criticism would be effortless if there were no people waiting for just such an appeal. Any fool can lampoon a king or a bishop or a billionaire. A trifle more grit is required to face down a mob or even a studio audience that has decided it knows what it wants and is entitled to get it. And the fact that kings and bishops and billionaires often have more say than most in forming the appetites and emotions of the crowd is not irrelevant either. Chapter 12. I admit to a certain wish to have it both ways on the matter of elitism and populism, a wish that is the stronger for being so seldom gratified, but I think I succeeded in avoiding tautology. You remind me, however, to stress again the fact that dissent in our time is thought by many people to be somehow a property of the left. Several misapprehensions arise from this one misapprehension, and one of them has to do with the reluctance to criticize popular wisdom or popular culture. Let me give you another, even more ludicrous example from the world of opinion polling. When President Reagan was discovered to have cancer in his colon, one major newspaper printed a poll in which people were solemnly asked if they thought the cancer would be cured, would recur, or would go into remission. Now, not even the enthusiasts of ultra-democracy would maintain that there could be any popular insight into the state of affairs in Reagan's bottom. Indeed, a crucial